feel that this song is true anymore. And I'm not sure that it is, but I know that it ought to be. So I'd like to do this for you, reminding you that with countries, just like with people, it's easy to let the best of yourself slip away. Well, once I rode that ribbon highway, I saw above me the endless sky. I saw below me a golden valley. Now this land was made for you and I roamed and I rambled, and I followed my footsteps through the sparkling sands of your diamond deserts. And all around me, a voice was sounding. It cried, this land was made for you and
this land was made for you and me. That's going to factor into our discussion today. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. That was Bruce Springsteen wrapping up his Born in the USA tour with Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land. It was live at the Memorial Coliseum in Los Angeles, California in 1985. There he sang the song. And the sentiments of the song give a hint as to where we're going today. We're talking about This Land's Not Your Land, the Great American Nativism Revival. Immigration and a slew of related issues, including U.S. immigration policy, hard borders, forced deportations, birthright citizenship, visa quotas, sender nations, and the social, political, economic, and cultural impact of immigration have become major planks now in presidential candidates' platforms and their own self-administered litmus test in a contest that's veering harder and harder to the right each day. Donald Trump, not surprisingly, claims credit for placing immigration at front and center of national discussion and debate. He also should accept responsibility for the decidedly xenophobic, patently racist tone of such discussions, which evoke America's centuries-old race-based ideas about who belongs and who does not belong here, and who shall have the right of citizenship. We are very fortunate today to have as our guest Tanya Golash Boza. She is the author of 5 books on the intersection of racism, nativism, and U.S. immigration policy, most recently, Race and Racisms, A Critical Approach. She's an associate professor of sociology at the University of California, Merced, and puts the candidates' cacophony about immigration into sharp perspective today. Her other books include Deported, Policing Immigrants, Disposable Labor, and Global Capitalism, Due Process Denied, which describes how and why non-citizens in the United States have been detained and deported for minor crimes without regard for constitutional limits on disproportionate punishment. Immigration Nation, which discusses the impact that U.S. immigration policy has on human rights. Yo Soy Negro, Blackness in Peru, the first book in English to address what it means to be black in Peru, and the current book, Race and Racisms, A Critical Approach. She also has published many articles in peer-reviewed journals on the subject areas in which she is an expert. And she has been awarded the University of California Merced Academic Senate Award for Distinguished Scholarly Public Service. Quite a resume, and that was the short version. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Good morning from California.
Thanks a lot. Well, let's start with the tone of things. As a person who has made this a specialty area, studying nativism, racism, and immigration, the tone of it should sound a bit familiar to you. What does it harken back to in our history?
Right. So immigration policy in the United States has always been tied to nativist/racist sentiments. So the very first law passed in the United States related to foreign-born persons was the Naturalization Act of 1790, and that stated that only free white persons were eligible for citizenship. And this law was later was used at the time to preclude African Americans and enslaved Africans from citizenship, and was later used to deny naturalization to Asians. And then the first comprehensive law governing entry into the United States was the Chinese Exclusion Act, signed into law in 1882. So whenever we talk about immigration policy, we talk about the history of immigration policy, we talk about overtly racist laws. And then we move a little bit forward in history to 1924, and we had a series of laws that were still overtly racist, not quite, not using the exact same rhetoric from the 1880s. And then we move forward to 1965, where we pass laws that no longer have these overtly racialized sentiments, but end up having disparate consequences for whites versus people of color. So when we look at what's going on today, we see that our laws, if you look at them on the books, there's no law that says, that Mexicans are going to get a different treatment than people from England. But if we look at what happens, 98% of people who are deported are from Latin America and the Caribbean. So we have a long history of racialized differences in immigration policy, and the way that it plays out and the way that people talk about it has changed in light of current discourses.
What generally, as you studied this area, as you've made a very consistent effort to, as you say, to analyze and present a comprehensive view of this subject matter, is there something that happens in society that basically promotes this discussion, or is it something that is you found to be just spontaneous? Is there something that happens in our society that generates this concern about immigration, and is it consistent with how other nations experience the same thing, this idea of who belongs and who does not belong?
Right. Okay, so if we think of it, what's really remarkable if you look at history is the Border Patrol wasn't created until 1924. So here in the United States, I know Donald Trump has made an outlandish policy to double the border and make a huge wall. And I think a lot of people in the United States would think, that's normal that the United States would want to enforce its borders with Mexico. But for most of the history of the United States, we had a basically open immigration policy with Mexico. We didn't establish the Border Patrol until 1924. And that was mostly to police the entry of Chinese. And it wasn't really until the 1980s that we began to see a widespread concern about undocumented immigrants, and particularly about undocumented Mexican immigrants. So that's related to large demographic trends. It's mostly related to Mexican immigrants settling in the United States for the first time. So prior to 1965, most Mexican migration was circular. Mexicans came and then they left. But we passed a law in 1965 that made it a little bit easier for Mexican immigrants to settle. And then we passed another law in 1986 that made it even easier for some Mexicans to settle and more difficult for them to go back. So when we think about the rise of anti-Mexican sentiment, which is tied to anti-undocumented people sentiment, it is very much tied to the consequences of the 1965 and the 1986 laws. And it's something that wasn't very prevalent, you know, prior to 1965.
But the country did have, there was a prevalence, and it lasted for quite a while, about this concept of who belonged here and who did not belong here. And it didn't just focus on Africans and Mexicans and Asians and so forth. This also was geared toward Europeans, some Europeans.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Could you discuss that a bit?
It shifted. Yeah. So in the 19... So, okay, well, if we think about the Europeans. So in 1924, we passed the immigration legislation law that basically was very overtly based in eugenics. So the idea at the time was that too many Southern and Eastern Europeans were coming into the United States, and they were interfering, they were messing up with the genetic pool of the United States. The United States was going to become a Mongol nation. We had too many inferior races coming into the United States, and by that they meant people from Southern and Eastern Europe. And also there was a sentiment that too many Asians were coming in, so there were laws passed that prevented the immigration of people from Asia. So that was passed in the context of in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, you had a lot of Italians, a lot of Jewish people coming to the United States. So there are large waves and they're settling into areas, and a lot of them are poor and working in factories and not having safe places to live. And a lot of people, and this is what we see today. So instead of saying, you know, there's a problem, there's all these immigrants coming in and their employers aren't paying them enough so they can't afford to keep nice homes. So the solution at the time and the solution today is, well, let's get rid of them. We have too many immigrants, instead of looking at what the root of the problem actually is. But like, as you said, in 1924, we passed this immigration law that restricted immigration from Southern Eastern Europe, from Poland, from Italy, in an effort to make the United States more Anglo-Saxon. And the interesting thing about that law that was passed in 1924 is it was passed just before Europe began its own trip towards recovery. So just before Italy and Poland, we're not going to be sending any more immigrants anyway. So today, when we look at Mexico, Mexico is also going through an economic and demographic transition where they're not going to, Mexican migration has been declining at least since 2007. So there's all this sentiment, you know, keep the Mexicans out, when in reality, very few Mexicans are coming to the United States.
Well, whether they were Polish or Italian or Jewish or Mexican or African or Caribbean or wherever it is they were coming from, the wall that they hit as immigrants was about this idea of who was white. Because mm-hmm. it seemed as if that was the common philosophy, that the people who would be granted the right of citizenship or the privilege of citizenship would be people who could basically extend and add to this notion that was already implanted deep in the fabric of American life, and that was whiteness in the political sense and in the cultural sense. This was to be a country of white people. And even right. the Poles didn't rate, the Italians didn't rate, Jews didn't rate. They were not white.
Right. They were not white, or they were not white enough. So in Race and Racism, I talk a little bit about the racialization of religion and the racialization of ethnicity. So the... So, and even the Catholics were not seen as white enough, right? So interestingly, when after 1924, when immigration from Europe was cut off, basically cut off between 1924 and 1965, it was during that period where where Jewish people and Italians and Irish were fully accepted into whiteness. So it's just to point out that it wasn't really anything necessarily about the people themselves that precluded them from being in whiteness. It was something about the time in which they were coming, the poverty they were living in, the prevailing views of the time. So we have a situation where they're coming in and they're not fully accepted as white. But once that period of fear is over, and once fewer of them start coming into the United States, they begin to be more accepted as whites.
So has something happened with that philosophy of whiteness, or has something else occasioned the revisiting of immigration by the powers that be about who should, in this day and age now, what is fueling the policy of immigration now? As before, it was clearly about maintaining whiteness and the domination of whiteness in the United States. Has that changed? You talked about the language changing from being explicitly racist to something more generic. So has the philosophy itself undergone a change?
Well, at least the discourses that surround immigration have changed. So we don't see, people don't say the same overtly racist things that they said in the 1920s about any group. I mean, marginal groups do, but no mainstream politician or mainstream news media is making overtly racist sentiments. What has changed? What has changed basically is the way people talk about things. And what hasn't changed is what I would call scapegoating. So today, right, to blame our economic troubles on immigrants is just, I mean, it's purely scapegoating, right? The United States had a kind of peak of immigration between 2000, between 1990 and 2000, or between, yeah, I would say between 1990 and 2000, and the economy was booming, and there was no reason to blame economic troubles on immigrants, even though we had a lot of immigrants. And then in 2007, 2008, we have a big bust. We have the Great Recession, and all of a sudden, it's like, oh well, let's blame the economic troubles on immigrants. But the interesting thing about scapegoating and the way these discourses work is you don't even need a crisis, right? In the United States, we have historically low violent and property crime rates, but nevertheless, politicians find it useful to blame crime on immigration, and it's just remarkable because we have very low crime rates in a time when we don't have as high immigration today as we did a decade ago. But during that time, the immigration was increasing in 1990, 2000. We saw a drop in our violent and our property crime rates. So it's kind of, it's almost like the reality is divorced, or the discourse is very much divorced from reality. But it is something, I guess, where politicians need someone to, not all politicians, but many politicians feel they need someone to blame. They need to come in. They need to be the savior. They need to be the good guy. And if you think about Mexican, you know, what Donald Trump says about Mexican immigrants, for example, he says, you know, oh, Mexico is not sending the good people. They're sending the rapists. They're sending the criminals. So first of all, that's simply not true. But secondly, just imagine if he said today, you know, well, Germany is sending us their rapists, sending us their criminals. I mean, no one would believe that, right? So it relies on his discourse, although it's not true, it relies on these stereotypes. So you just couldn't make the same claims. And you couldn't even though there is a lot of discrimination against Asians in the United States, the stereotypes are not the same. So he probably couldn't even say, you know, the Chinese are sending us their criminals, their rapists, right? Because people in the United States don't have that set of stereotypes about Chinese people.
So people who are making these claims publicly are playing into a long and deep-seated racial conditioning that we are stereotyping people, and it's easier to transfer our stereotypes to a particular group and blame them for the fact that the country is pretty much, you know, going to hell in a handbasket, and there's somebody who's got to be blamed. But we see this all over the world. We have it in Israel, where we have the Palestinian issue or the migrant issue, and people are saying the Jewish way of life in Israel is imperiled by these people. We have, you know, in African nations, one tribal group blaming the other tribal group for the problems. So this is not unique in that sense. But it is unique in the United States because the culture of the United States, I would contend, was one literally framed in the context, just absolutely based on this notion of whiteness and white supremacy, and that it was to prevail at all costs. And this is just another one of those things, that a tool to keep that idea going, that we have people who are corrupting our, quote, way of life, unquote. And these mm-hmm. are coded words for, you know, maintaining whiteness. We get it. So when a Donald yes. Trump comes out and then he's joined by Chris Christie, who says something stupid like, well, we should now use a method of controlling immigrants the way FedEx controls its packages. And when we have other people giving their versions of it, essentially, they're all basically arguing on the point of who still belongs here, and the notion that the whiteness, the culture of whiteness, is under assault.
Yeah, no, I would agree that the underlying discourse about who belongs, or we can see this, for example, if you look at if there was an analysis done a few years ago of media outlets, and whenever they said, they would always say American, American, American. They would never say white American. But if they wanted to refer to a particular group, they would say African American, or they would say Latino or Latino American, Mexican American. So when we say American, usually whiteness is implied. So when we say we need to protect our values, we need to protect our country, we need to protect our customs. Today, you don't have to say we need to protect, and you can't say, a politician can't publicly say we need to protect white America, because then he would be decried a racist. And there's an interesting situation in the United States where nobody wants to be a racist, right? If you call someone a racist, it's seen as a tremendous insult, and no one wants to be viewed as a racist. So we have a paradox of widespread racism, widespread racial inequality. You know, African-American men are 7 times more likely than white men to go to prison. African-Americans and Latinos have 1/20 the wealth of white Americans. So there's clearly structural racism, structural inequality in the United States. But nobody wants to be blamed for enacting that. Right? And then there are all kinds of studies that show that if you send identical resumes to employers, that they're going to give preference to people who they perceive to be white Americans over people they perceive to be African American because of the name, or Latino because of the name, or even Asian because of the name. So there's a tremendous amount of empirical evidence that there's racial inequality, racial discrimination, racial bias in the United States, but nobody wants to admit that they're the perpetrators. So we have this paradox of racism without racists, which is very different from the early 20th century when we had racism with racists, right? People who were very willing to admit that they were proponents of eugenics, so they thought that people of color should be sterilized, or they thought Mexicans should be sterilized. So that's one thing that has changed. But as you implied earlier, the underlying sentiment of white superiority and fear of protecting white America has not dissipated.
I want to talk about your particular studies and the seminal point that you have gotten in writing your 5 books about immigration. What would you say would be the top conclusions that you have come to about immigration and immigration policy?
I would say, especially with regards to how we think about racism, So most people in the United States, not everybody, but most people that I talk to, when I explain to them that, you know, a person who is a legal permanent resident of the United States, that's lived here for 30 years, that has 5 children and 3 grandchildren, could be picked up on the streets and having served time as a teenager for drug possession, could be deported without due process, you know, could basically be arrested and detained, denied their rights, denied and not given access to a lawyer, and then deported to a country that they hadn't been to since they were a toddler. So when I tell that kind of story, most people are kind of shocked that the person doesn't get a full hearing, that they're not provided with a lawyer, that we can just separate them from their family. And I think that the tremendous lack of procedural protections in deportation proceedings, and combined with mass deportation, we have today we have, you know, around 400,000 deportations a year, which is historically unprecedented. And that that wouldn't happen if the targets were perceived as white, right? It just, we don't, and there's no policy in the United States that is systematically applied in such a repressive manner when the perceived targets are white. So the same thing if you look at, if we look at mass incarceration, right? The fact that someone can spend their life behind bars for a few marijuana convictions or for stealing a bicycle, if the main targets of that policy were perceived to be white, I just don't think those policies would be in place. So it's very interesting how this has happened, where what I've argued actually in the past is that white Americans and white foreigners can be subjected to these laws. And when they are, they're often tremendously surprised, that, and their families are very surprised. You know, when I meet people who, I met a guy from England recently, and his son, their legal permanent residency, his son was, you know, a teenager in high school and got a drug conviction, and he was, he and all his friends, middle-class friends, were very surprised that his son was now facing deportation, even though they were here legally and had lived here for many years. So I just think that if, that the laws are tremendously unfair, and most people, if they really understood how unfair and in many ways American the laws are, that they wouldn't exist if the targets were not primarily people of color. So just with regard to deportation, 98% of people deported from the United States are from Latin America and the Caribbean. So even though the laws are extremely harsh, they almost never affect immigrants from Europe.
Now, that is startling right there. I mean, we would never think that based on how the discourse is going and the dialogue is presented and the stories are covered by major media. That fact that you just said is not normally known, is not normally discussed. Yeah. Nor the fact that we think that, you know, this hard turn on immigration is Republican, you know, largely Republican. And we forget that the Obama administration, in fact, holds the record for mass deportations. In fact, he was called the deporter in chief, you know, sending more than 2 million people out of the country under these same contentious circumstances. In five years, he deported more people than George W. Bush and his administration deported in 8 years. So President Obama's administration was far more efficient and far more zealous about this matter of deportation, making people like Donald Trump, even with his outlandish claims now, seem tame by comparison. So you have a Democrat, a liberal Democrat, a progressive Democrat, behaving just like the most rabid of Republicans. What does this say? Is it about the political ideology here, or is it about systemic resistance to, and this whole thing again perpetuating and looking to this notion of maintaining white supremacy in the United States?
I think it has a lot to do with the fact that nobody's constituency is a criminal alien. So when you create a population and you call them criminal aliens, it's very easy to kind of scapegoat them. And the one I'm going to mention, a couple other facts. So you mentioned that President Obama in 5 years has overseen the deportation of, or overseen 2 million deportations. By the end of his presidency, he will have overseen 3 million deportations, and that's 50% more than the sum total of every single deportation prior to 1997. And 1997 is a key year because, as you'll recall, President Bill Clinton was in office, also a Democrat, also regarded as progressive by some people. And what President Bill Clinton did in 1996 is he signed into law three pieces of legislation that have been devastating for immigrants, for people of color, and for women. So what the 1996 laws did together is they removed those due process protections that I was talking about earlier. They denied immigrants access to social services, and then they created the it was interesting because the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act was implemented in the aftermath of the Oklahoma City bombings and other terrorist acts carried out by white people. But the ultimate effect has been to deny a whole slew of rights to immigrants, mostly from Latin America.
Well, I just wanted to return to this question of Latin America for a minute because I want it definitively said for our audience, just so that they can appreciate how this particular issue is so distorted. We are told that the masses of people who are posing the problem, immigration problem, are Mexican. We are conditioned to have no sympathy at all for Mexicans because, well, gee, you know, they're just coming here to take advantage of our benefits. And that brings us to the nativist sentiment. Could you talk about how nativism is being used to prop up this argument, first creating the stereotype of Mexicans accounting for the immigration, illegal immigration, as I say, problem, and two, how nativism is now being used very astutely to galvanize a political constituency?
Right. So first I'll say undocumented immigration from Mexico has only decreased. So the population of undocumented Mexicans in the United States 2007 has decreased by 1 million people. In that same time, the population of Asians, of undocumented Asians, has doubled. So the problem is, but the problem continues to be painted as a Mexican problem, in part because it's easy for politicians and for media outlets and for pundits to rely on these stereotypes that we have about Mexicans and to rely on nativism. So, right, as you said, nativism is the idea that we should protect our own, we should protect our country first. And it sounds like patriotism. But the interesting thing is, there's this idea in the United States that the United States, you know, created itself. It brought itself up by its bootstraps. And that ignores the long colonial history of the United States. It ignores the wars we had with Mexico, the taking over of the Mexican territories. It ignores the fact that during World War II, when the United States was in desperate need of employees, of farmhands. Actually, the interesting thing, so in California, we often conflate Mexican labor with farm labor. But actually, prior to the passage of the Asian exclusion laws in the early 1900s, most of our farm laborers were from Asia due to the ties between the United States and Asia at the time. But once we passed the Asian exclusion laws, we did.
In the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw the people, and they were hungry, and they were wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is mine land.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're continuing our discussion here on PRN and on Lead Stories with our guest, Tanya Golash-Boza, who has written 5 books on the intersection of racism, nativism, and U.S. immigration policy, the most recent book being Race and Racism's A Critical Approach. She is an associate professor of sociology at the University of California, Merced, And we are discussing the matter of immigration today in a way that hopefully will give you some grounding in the subject, so when it is continually covered, you have an entirely different point of reference. Well, we lost you there for a minute. Glad you're back.
Thank you for having me back. I'm not sure when I get cut off, so hopefully I won't repeat myself.
Well, glad that you're back with us. So continue from where you left off.
So as I was saying, in a lot of people don't know this, but in California, in the early 20th century, most of our crops were tended by people from Asia. Then the United States passed a series of laws that precluded Asians from coming to the United States. And it was country by country, so first China and then Japan and then finally the Philippines, which was a territory of the United States. And then finally we excluded the Filipinos. And it was at that point where we began to rely on Mexican labor in the United States. And it was that point that we, in 1942, we implemented the Bracero program. So people often make the argument that that Mexicans come to the United States and take our, quote-unquote, our jobs without realizing the long history, our long colonial history with Mexico, our long colonial history with the Philippines and other countries that send us migrants. And in particular, when we think about farm labor in the United States, California and the Pacific Northwest has now relied on Mexicans to pick our crops at least since 1942. If you think about, so what would happen if Mexican immigrants no longer pick the crops in California? What would happen if we completely cut off Mexican immigration to the United States and expelled, as Donald Trump has tried to make the case, expelled all the undocumented Mexicans and then expelled their children. So who would, there's some people that make the argument, Americans won't do those jobs. And I wouldn't make that argument because Americans have done and will do all kinds of jobs. But what you won't see is a massive displacement of urban people to rural areas to pick crops, right? That's just something you don't see in history. We have seen it a couple of times in Russia, right? So during the period of Stalin, or in China during the period of Mao, right, where you can force people to go to the countryside to pick crops, but you just never, if you think about the long course of history, you're never going to see a massive displacement of urbanites to rural areas to pick crops. So if we were to completely cut off Mexican immigration, just using this one example of California food production, basically what would happen is that California food production would move to Mexico. I mean, that's probably going to happen anyway with the drought, who knows, but it's not the case that Mexicans take our jobs. And you could use, if you look at it industry by industry, you could see that industries have just become completely reliant on immigrant labor, which is a problem of many times of the industries, but it's certainly not, you can't just blame the immigrants for it and expect that if we expel all the immigrants. And that's another example would be meatpacking. So as many people know, in the 1960s and 70s, meatpacking plants were concentrated in cities like Chicago, and immigrants from Europe and other countries worked in those meatpacking factories, and they were unionized, and they had decent wages. But then during the period of deindustrialization in the United States, the meatpacking owners decided to move their production, and many times they moved to places like Iowa. So this is an example of a meatpacking factory that moved to Iowa in 1982, when the local unemployment is 2%, which is, less than 5% is already considered basically zero. So the idea that you would move your meatpacking factory from Chicago, which has relatively high unemployment, to Iowa, which has practically none, means that you're not planning to use the local Iowa labor force in the first place. And they weren't. They were planning to use immigrants, so they recruited immigrants from Mexico to come and work in the meatpacking plants. And then these meatpacking plants have an average turnover of 12 months. Every 12 months, they have to replace their workforce. So the way meatpacking is done today, it's not designed to employ a local stable population. It's designed to employ a disposable immigrant population. So we could totally reconceive how we produce food in the United States, which would be a wonderful conversation to have. But to simply expel immigrants, you wouldn't be handing over jobs to native-born people.
Well, one of the things you consistently point to is how this issue of racist nativism is intertwined with immigration policy. Do you see evidence of that happening now, that there is a growing racist nativism, however it's caused, whether by the candidates or by media or by whomever? But is it something that you sense is growing, and is it likely now to inform immigration policy?
Yeah, I don't have a good handle on whether or not nativism is growing or whether or not it's remained stable. What's clear is that it's consistent, right, that you consistently see examples of racialized nativism or of nativism in candidate speeches, and from both sides. I mean, even when President Obama says, we're going to deport felons, not families, right? So there's no overt racism in that comment. But when people hear that, they think of Mexican immigrants, they think of Latino immigrants, or other politicians will say, well, you know, MS-13 gang members. So they don't have to use words that are overtly racist in order to conjure up these stereotypes of Latino criminals. So I'm not familiar with studies that show a rise or a fall in nativism. I guess I would say I haven't seen any study that shows for sure that there's a rise in nativism in the present time. But I would just say that it's a consistent campaign tactic, because for all of the politicians, their base is not what they would call criminal aliens. So they feel very free to attack people that they can label as a criminal alien, which is the official government term for a non-citizen who has been convicted of a crime.
What is the impact of this attitude within the United States in the sender nations? How are they reacting to what's going on in terms of their people being so stereotyped and marginalized?
Right. I mean, there certainly is a sentiment in Mexico, for sure, that's what I'd be most familiar with, that people in the United States are, have no idea of the incredible economic, cultural, and social diversity of Mexico. So that again feeds into the stereotype of the provincial American, right? The American who imagines that all Mexicans are undocumented farm laborers. So I think there's definitely the sentiment in Mexico that people in the United States have very stereotyped views of Mexicans and are very provincial and not capable of imagining that that Mexicans come in all shades. That Mexicans have, I mean, if you thought about it for a second, right, obviously Mexico has professionals, but sort of the idea, the surprise that people express when they meet someone from Mexico and find out that they're a doctor or a lawyer is just astounding, right? Because how could Mexico operate if it didn't have doctors and lawyers? So I think there's certainly a sentiment in Mexico, which is the major sending country, that people in the United States are very provincial in there and very easily fall into these stereotypes. Into believing these stereotypes.
So Donald Trump starts off by attacking Mexicans. Okay. And now we have, on the flip side, people saying, oh, no, it's not the Mexicans that we ought to be afraid of. It's the Chinese. And others mm-hmm. will say, well, it's not them. It's people from the Caribbean. So each person, in effect, is trying to outdo the xenophobia of Donald Trump. So we are seeing, witnessing, are we not, a climate change here, a political climate and a cultural climate and a social climate? Of course, the big prize is the White House. They want to do whatever it is they mm-hmm. have to do to get it. They understand how racism works in this country, and they are pandering to racist fears. Do you see that in the next couple of months, is it likely to get worse? Or is it likely to just taper off and people say, well, wait a minute, you know, we really have to calibrate the tone of our campaign. It is kind of ugly right now, and we don't look so good as a nation.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I was reading through a couple of articles today about Donald Trump, and there was certainly a common thread in the articles that white working class Americans appreciate the racism of Donald Trump. And I wouldn't be so sure of that. What sociological studies have found is that working class white people are actually more likely to work alongside non-whites and actually to have more positive views. So the interesting thing about middle class white Americans is we're more capable of disguising our views. So we might say middle class white Americans might very dearly hold the stereotype that all Mexican women are house cleaners. And they wouldn't necessarily say, you know, Mexicans are no good. All they can do is clean houses. But when they meet a Mexican-American, a colleague of mine is Mexican-American, and when she's in a lot of settings, people presume, you know, she might be the housekeeper or are surprised to find out that she holds a middle-class profession. So it's interesting that the media is kind of playing on this stereotype of white working-class people to argue that they're buying into the racism of Donald Trump. And I don't know how true that is. So I think there is some hope for Donald Trump falling on his face and, so to speak, by using all this racist rhetoric, because white working class Americans are much more likely to work alongside people of color, especially urban working class Americans, and are much less likely to hold these simplistic stereotypes about Mexicans in particular.
Does it strike you as odd that we're not hearing vehement objection to this tone and to the thrust of it, which is, you know, attacking specific groups of people, and you can't deny the racial link here. Are you surprised that you're not hearing this from people in white middle class America and for the white intellectuals, and we're not hearing a consistent pushback against this? I think I'm hearing it more and more. So in my head, it's a rising tide. It's becoming part of the American consciousness that this is the way you ought to think, because this is the way they all think, whether they're Republican or Democrat. Are you surprised that we're not getting this kind of the flip side of the coin, a consistent attack against this kind of racial rhetoric?
I think we saw the answer to that in the Bernie Sanders fiasco with regard to Black Lives Matter. So leftist politicians in the United States often have a pretty good handle on economic problems, but don't have a good handle on how to talk about race. It's a very uncomfortable issue. So I think someone like Bernie Sanders, presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders, could develop a more refined analysis of race, and he could do that in a way that would broaden his base. And there's no reason why he can't. He's a perfectly intelligent man, but it's hard for him to do that, I think, because of who he is and because of where he's from and because of the simplistic racial stories that most people in the United States believe. So I'm not that surprised, but I certainly think it's possible that a candidate could sharpen their racial analysis and could come up with a compelling counter narrative to what Donald Trump has to say, but I think they would have to work closely with politically savvy anti-racist people in order to develop that strategy. So I think it may seem like, you know, it should be easy for them to just counter what Donald Trump says, but I think that you actually need a pretty sharp racial analysis, and that most politicians don't have that, and that might be one of the reasons why we haven't seen a good counter message coming either from the left or from the right.
What's next for you? This is an area that you devoted considerable amount of time to and effort to, writing these five books and the articles that you write for peer review. What is, in your view, one of the most important areas to address within this discussion of immigration and nativism and racism?
So if we think about, mass deportation, which is ongoing and is projected to continue at least through the end of the Obama presidency. It may change or may not change depending on who's next and how they choose to handle Department of Homeland Security. Now, one thing that really strikes me is the children left behind when a person is deported from the United States, they very rarely take their children with them. So their children grow up in the United States knowing that the U.S. government has taken one or both of their parents away. So I think that's an area that not only that is of immediate importance, but will be important for the long haul, because these kids are going to grow up, right? And there's lots of them. Last year, 100,000 parents of U.S. citizens were deported, right? So these, and every year, so that's kind of been consistent. So we're going to have, you know, perhaps millions of children growing up in the United States knowing that the U.S. government took away their parent. I think that's something that we're going to have to contend with for the generations to come.
I want to thank you so much, Professor Tanya Golash-Boza, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Merced, for being with us today and for giving us this wonderful backdrop to a discussion that I can see will last for months to come, because it is tied to the big race for the White House in 2016. But your work, I wish you the best in continuing your work, and thank you for the work you already have done, and thank you for being with us today. Hopefully you can come back again. I would love to have the audience ask you, you know, lots and lots of questions. Today was really a classroom, so we did more of the listening today as opposed to asking you some questions, but I'd like to have you back again soon to continue the discussion.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, and I'd certainly be happy to speak with you and the audience again in the future.
Thank you. Well, I hope that helped bring your attention to what's happening here in this discussion of immigration. And what is happening is that there's a very crude calculation about how you're going to get people fired up. What could you do to fire up people's imagination as a candidate? It doesn't matter how much damage you cause with a reckless misapplication of the science of the thing or even the facts of the thing that you're talking about. All you need to know, as Donald Trump quite accurately has calculated, all you need to know is the racial disposition of Americans and what they're likely to entertain, what they're likely to believe, what they want to hear from you, that a mass group, that's what they want to hear. Let's go and beat up somebody for no reason. The factual reasons, as Dr. Golash was telling us today, the factual reasons are very clear. In fact, Mexican immigration into the United States has slowed down considerably. So the notion, just the idea of promoting the lie that they're just running wild over the borders, no. Life has been so outrageously hard for Mexicans by virtue of racial stereotypes and racist attitudes that they're encountering in the United States, and by an administration, we just heard again, the Democratic administration of Barack Obama exceeding all other presidencies in the deportation of Mexicans. We had heard here on the occasion of Cinco de Mayo that Mexico, if for no other reason than a sentimental nod to the fact that Mexico was a liberator of African slaves, and Mexico declared an end to slavery. Mexico had the first black president in the hemisphere. So you see a president, an African-American president, a black president, literally divorcing himself from all of that and saying, hey, you know, we need to have a far more intelligent approach to this question. This is not to say that immigration is not important, but it is to say that we need to have intelligent policy, and intelligent and policy just don't go together in the American scheme of things. It just don't. It's whatever it is that needs to be done to keep powerful constituency happy and quiet. That brings us to the end of the program today. I hope it was helpful. Tomorrow, a great program is scheduled for you. We will be talking about the auto industry tomorrow and some really incredible insights into what has happened there and what continues to happen as the auto workers, or what's left of auto workers in the United States, seek some kind of parity with the outfits that they work for. Thank you for joining me. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. Coming up next, the Global Research News Hour with Michael Welch. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
From California, New York Island, Redwood Forest, the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made.